So welcome everybody. It's lovely to see you all here. Thank you for your dedication to the practice and also your dedication to the causes of this major cause, if you will, to work to save life on this planet. David does not need introductions. He is a friend of ours already. We know him very well because we read his book. So without any further ado, I'm going to pass the baton on to David, and I'm going to mute myself, and I would ask everybody to stay muted until we open up for questions, okay? Thank you.
Well, thank you, Piero. Thank you to everyone for, first of all, your interest in the Ecodharma book and your concern for what's happening to the Earth. That means a lot to me, and I'm really happy to join you. And I want to thank particularly Piero for arranging all this. It's great to see some old friends and to meet some new ones. I don't know if Piero mentioned it, maybe some of you caught it, but I just came back from a long 5-week trip to Europe, mostly teaching, and all of that was on Ecodharma. And I'm happy to say something about that. I actually don't have a presentation plan because I'm hoping all of you have questions. And I'm very happy to say what I can in response to those, but also hoping that it won't just be, you know, you asking a question and me giving an answer, but that we can have a real sort of sharing and discussion here. It occurs to me that one way to start us off, it would be the three questions that Piero sent me. I don't know if everyone else is familiar with them, but it might be good, Piero, if you sort of ask them again, and then I can say a few words. Maybe that would be a good way to go.
So if I remember, I asked you, I think that the Rocky Mountain Ecodharma Retreat Center is something that you participated in the creation, and you have been there facilitating retreats and teaching for many years now. So I guess that the question that I asked you was, from your times there, perhaps you can give us some story, some personal insight that you had, or what do you experience when you go there? Because many times you have referred to those 2 or 3 weeks that in the middle of the year you do the inner and outer retreat as the best days of the year for you, or the most joyous days of the year for you.
Right.
And so I guess that we could start there.
Sure. Sorry, I thought you had the questions. I have them before me here. let me just mention parenthetically before I respond to your question is that we're actually expanding next summer. You know, we won't be actually sort of advertising until the beginning of the new year, I think. But we're going to have one more Ecodharma retreat. The way it's been for a while now, we've had two connected, and sometimes people do both. There's the Ecodharma retreat, the inner and outer one that Piero referred to, and then there's also kind of a nature retreat, which is, you know, more focused on just being in nature. And we're going to add another Ecodharma retreat next summer. And if I remember correctly, that one might be a little bit shorter because it won't involve the solo, where people go off for 2 days and two nights by themselves toward the end of the retreat. So I just want to mention that in case, you know, you or someone that you know might be interested. It'll be pretty much the same time, you know, late July, early August. We'll have the three of them in a row. Okay, back to your question. There's really nothing so mysterious about it in terms of my saying it's the most joyful or the happiest time of the year for me. I mean, I get to have, 2.5 weeks living in this incredibly beautiful place, right? Spending, as we all do, just about all of my time out in the natural world, but also with a community of people who share the same concern about what's happening to the Earth, you know? And this is huge. It's like finding our community is no small thing these days. And so I think it's just the combination of being in nature there and just feeling this pretty quick, if not instant, sense of connection to the other people who are there for the same reason I am, in terms of wanting to deepen our understanding of to deepen our connection with the natural world, for one thing, because that's an important part of it. As somebody said, it's hard to work. It's hard to love and work for something if you don't have a connection with it, right? So actually spending a lot of time out in nature is a really important part of our retreat, but also sharing our concerns, sharing our grief, our fears, our anxieties, our concerns together. It's just really, really powerful. In fact, living together 24/7 as we do, and spending all this time out in nature, but it's also not a classical Buddhist retreat in the sense that no one is talking. We're also having some workshopy stuff, some there's a lot of quiet meditation, but there's also a fair amount of time to talk and share. And that combination I just find really, really powerful every time. I never get tired of it. I always kind of look forward to it as I said, the height, the most joyful time of my year. Sorry, I guess I built into that a real advertisement for the Eco Dharma Center.
That's wonderful. And it's interesting that you mentioned love, but you also mentioned the grief and the anxiety that we share. So we go there and we share the grief and the anxiety. And yeah, we talked, and there is that the evening bonfire that is also an opportunity for the Dharma talks. It's a wonderful thing. But from how many years have you had the center, and any do you write there? Do you have insights there? I mean, just expand on this, if you will.
Good question. How long have we had the center? Maybe something like 6 years now. That's a rough number. I have never written there. I have done a short solo in the lodge because we're closed in the winter time, between basically after Thanksgiving until sometime usually in late April. We are just finishing a cabin. Piero, you may remember that little cabin, an old 19th century log cabin, which we've been spending a lot of time and energy and money, unfortunately, fixing up. And that will be available for like solo retreats. And I expect, sometime I'll want to spend more time there. But the problem is, we don't really have the facilities for a community. We have the resident managers or manager during the time that we're having retreats, but otherwise, basically, just about everyone comes and goes, for the retreats. And not all of them are Eco Dharma retreats. Sometimes it's more just being in nature. But we are expanding the Eco Dharma focus as we can.
Yeah, wonderful. And so I think that we could move on to, I don't know if you want to talk more about this, but we could move on perhaps to your trip to Europe, your recent trip to Europe, because I think that we were curious to know. You have a clear view of the movement here in the US, and perhaps you already had, but perhaps this was an opportunity to refresh your view about Eco Dharma and the work that is being done, at least in Europe and Germany, the two countries where you have taught recently. So can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I have a fairly strong European connection, partly because my wife is British and we used to go there very regularly. The very first Eco Dharma Center actually started in northeast Spain, founded by a member of the Triratna Order, Guhyapati. And it's worth checking them out online. The Eco Dharma Center with the British spelling, Centre. And they're much bigger than us. They have most of a valley up in Catalonia, and they're doing all kinds of pretty amazing things. They're very much at a different scale from us. But otherwise, it's worth mentioning because people have made this point several times. The growing tip of global Buddhism, whether we like it or not, is the United States. It's like people sort of expect, that's where people think that things happen, and they sort of want to learn what's going on here. And I think that's, despite that Eco-Dharma Center in Spain, I think this also applies to interest in Eco-Dharma generally. So the reason I was invited is because there are people interested there, but also the organizers want to kind of jump start, sort of make it more visible, right? So the Eco-Dharma book has been translated into Italian, Spanish, Portuguese, German. And in the case of both Italy and Germany, you know, they were kind of pushing the book. That was part of my agenda, and it was an opportunity to talk about that. The interest is definitely growing. It's a little bit hard to say because exactly where things are at, because of course the people who would come to my talks and workshops are the ones who are already somewhat interested. But in general, talking to them, there's very much the feeling that eco-dharma is something that more and more people are concerned about. This time, I was supposed to start my trip with actually a full eco-dharma retreat in Italy near Pisa. For complicated reasons, that had to be canceled. But there's talk in both Italy and in Germany, maybe a workshop in Portugal. Basically, I wouldn't be surprised if I'm invited back to offer Eco-Dharma retreats next year. What I was offering this time was mostly sort of talks on the Eco-Sattva path, and there were a couple sort of 1 or 2 day workshops. But as the interest grows and people are willing to sort of commit themselves more to organizing and attending, I think we're going to be having more Eco-Dharma retreats, and hopefully along the line of what we're doing here in Colorado.
What was the sense of urgency that you detected on the people that you were talking about the ecological crisis?
It's a good question. You know, it varies a lot. There are some people clearly who are very kind of far along here. They're very, very concerned about what's happening, and their interest is how Buddhism might contribute to understanding and responding. And there's also a fair number of people for whom they're coming more just from the classical Buddhist meditation approach, or they just want to sort of explore more and see how this connects with the ecological situation. So I think, as you'd expect, there's a fair spectrum. I did have some people, both in Italy and in Germany, who were members of groups like Extinction Rebellion. And of course, for them, that's a very urgent issue.
Tell the group more about these groups, Extinction Rebellion and other groups, please.
Extinction Rebellion is a group that started in England a few years ago, and it also has a significant presence in the United States here, and they're very much committed to direct action, you know, nonviolent civil disobedience to sort of raise consciousness, because they think things are so urgent. You know, why aren't we responding in an urgent way? We're doing stuff, but not nearly enough, not nearly quickly enough. I was a member of Extinction Rebellion. In a way, I still am, but things got messed up by COVID. You know, we were doing things, and then that kind of closed things down for a while. So we did do something. We did do an action up in Denver where we blocked a road, and I was arrested, and along with some other people, and
Badge
we
of
ended up
honor.
having. I'm sorry?
I said badge of honor.
Well, actually, you know, I started out as a draft resister, so it felt like returning to my roots, you know, Vietnam War era and all that sort of thing, back in the late 60s, early 70s. So it felt good. And anyway, so Extinction Rebellion, in addition to Extinction Rebellion, there is a group within Extinction Rebellion called Extinction Rebellion Buddhists. They're, yeah, especially strong in England, but we also have them in New York and in Massachusetts in particular. So they're very much concerned about, you know, bringing Buddhist principles into Extinction Rebellion. I've met with a number of them in New York, and I suppose it's worth mentioning that some years ago, again, prior to COVID, which sort of messed up a lot of things, we did have a activist retreat up at the Eco Dharma Center, primarily Extinction Rebellion, but there were other types of activists where we were, you know, exploring together the linkage between civil disobedience and our ecological situation. And that was very moving. Interestingly, a number of the people in that group, XR, Extinction Rebellion, they already had some meditation background. Yeah. So we're, you know, one thing we're concerned is to sort of continue that, as things kind of more stabilize, we're going to look more into how we can continue those kinds of retreats. Yeah.
Wonderful. So this is the last question before we open the floor for everybody to ask questions as well. So I asked you in that email that I said, you are the president going to Congress to address the Congress and the nation with the State of the Union. And I wanted you to do a State of the World for us regarding, I don't know, hope and despair.
It's interesting how we keep coming back to that, and in a way, I think it's sort of inevitable, isn't it? Regarding the state of the earth, let's put it that way. I mean, clearly we're doing more, but I'd say just as clearly we're not doing enough. And there is some interesting good news. I don't know if anyone reads the New York Times. There's an article by what's his name? Wallace Wells in the latest New York Times, where he talked about how things, I mean, he published a few years ago a very grim account of our situation. And in this article, he says, well, given how quickly we are shifting to renewables, things don't look quite as grim as I thought back then. So he's somewhat more, dare I say it, hopeful. He still thinks we're going to be, you know, having some pretty awful results as a result of the increasing carbon. But he now thinks that it's not, well, he's just summing up the research, right? So he thinks that we won't be as bad as he once feared, just because decarbonization is happening so quickly, and largely because it's very cheap. It's actually cheaper than fossil fuels in many cases now. So, you know, you can read that and then you feel optimistic or hopeful, and then you can go back and read other accounts of not just about the climate crisis. I mean, people focus so much on that. In a way, we have to, but we also have to remember that's just the tip of a much larger ecological crisis, including loss of biodiversity, you know, cutting down forests, loss of topsoil, increasing pollution in the ocean and the air and the water, in our bodies, and so forth. So, you know, one can go back and forth, and I think the good thing about it is that it sort of keeps us from getting complacent, and it also plugs into what I think is an essential Buddhist teaching for these times and for this is, you know, the don't know mind. It's like we really have to develop that, our ability to live in uncertainty and to not be paralyzed by that. That said, coming back to the issue of hope and despair or optimism and pessimism, you know, I've been saying for a long time about the problem with them as kind of dualistic, that whenever I mean, an optimism is always going to be sort of shadowed or haunted by pessimism, and the same thing with hope and despair. I mean, one of the big things that I focus on is distinguishing despair from grief, right? Despair is a head trip about the future. We don't know. Grief is something we feel right here and now about what's happening right here and now. I think our practice, one important thing about our meditation practice is that it can really help to distinguish those. It can help us to see and let go of the head trips, at the same time really helping us get in touch, like bodily, as it were, with what's going on. I'm always reminded of that memorial to 9/11 in downtown London. You know, grief is the price we pay for love. And, you know, our grief is not a bad thing. In fact, I think our grief can be very empowering as far as cutting through a lot of the bullshit of our lives and really helping us focus, you know.
Beautiful.
Still, you know, the one thing I would say, is it a matter of getting rid of hope? I remember that quotation from Joanna Macy, where she pointed out, you will not, unlike Christianity, think of Paul, the letters, faith, hope, and charity. Hope, one of the three big things he emphasizes, right? Well, you're not going to find any discussion, or at least I haven't been able to find any discussion in any of the Buddhist teachings about hope. That's not a Buddhist virtue. That's not emphasized. And as Joanna says, that would tend to take us out of the present moment. Still, I think it's natural to hope. The important thing is maybe not sort of trying to expunge all hope, but to be aware of what's going on, not to be identified with it so tightly, so that when the inevitable moments of despair also come, we don't get identified with them, right? So it's like they're going to be part of what's going on in our minds as we respond to what's going on. It's just, I just think the really important thing is not to get stuck in them, mm-hmm. and, you know, not to get so identified, if that makes any sense. So, you know, it's like everything else. We learn in the meditation, the idea of meditation isn't to get rid of all thinking and feeling, but it's to sort of not be identified or in the usual way.
I really want to open the floor just with this comment. Yeah. Sometimes we are all doing something, mm-hmm. you know, and even though we know that the little things that we do contribute in a way, but sometimes we get this in despair. I'm going to use this word because we say, well, the problem is so big and what I'm doing is really not affecting change in a way. But I remember what you wrote and said many times, that we keep doing without ever knowing if we're doing is going to make any difference. And I think that this is part of the ekosattva vow, or to just keep doing what we can without knowing if we're going to affect change or not.
What else do we want to do with our lives? I mean, at this point in history, what? Do I want to drink more alcohol or eat more chocolate? Or, I mean, it's like we're called, you know, this is, Chomsky says, this is the most dangerous moment in human history. I think he's right. We're all being called here. If we open up to what's going on in our practice, we can feel this. We don't know what the result is going to be, but this sense of calling and responding as well as we can. What else do we want to do with our lives at this urgent time? Yeah.
Beautiful. Thank you, David. So I'm opening the floor. Raise your hands if you want to say something. You know, one of the things that came up during our book discussion were other authors, some of them you mentioned in the book. And so Dan brought up the book by Paul Hawken called Regeneration, I believe it's the name of the book. And I think that many of us are very interested in going there. So Dan first and then Lynn. Dan.
Okay, I wasn't going to talk about regeneration though. Actually, I was, you know, looking back at my notes and about chapter 5 in particular, where you talk about the tendency that people have to deny, you know, what's unpleasant. And so you call upon Buddhists to, you know, to recognize our tendency to denial and to work on acceptance by cultivating gratitude, allowing ourselves to feel grief for the, you know, suffering that's going to take place. And finally, you know, working towards a new basis for civilization. But, you know, it makes me wonder, when is there going to be kind of a tipping point of public opinion in a country like the United States? When are we going to have a kind of, I call it a World War II moment, you know, where there's a kind of uniting against a common energy and enemy, sorry. And, but when I think about this, I think about the fact that in wars in the past, you've had business all behind the war effort because they were going to profit from it. And here we need something that could be considered against business as usual. On the third hand, there's the countervailing force of green business. I just don't know how all this is going to kind of sort out so that public opinion gets moved in the direction it needs to get moved soon enough for us to really all think of the climate crisis as a kind of common enemy. So that's a sort of question, what you think about that.
Well,
and
I mean,
anybody else can.
I mean, I'm happy to say something, but I also don't know that I have any monopoly of wise responses or anything like that. Yeah. Thank you for that. And I mean, I think the basic answer to your fundamental question about, you know, when, I don't know. And I certainly don't know if it's going to happen in time or as the sort of climate disasters pile up, if that'll help more and more awaken. But it seems like we're getting those disasters. It's happening, but it's, again, happening very slowly, you know. The other issue is, and I appreciate the way you put your finger on it, Dan, we're very good at mobilizing against an enemy, but when the enemy is in a way ourselves, it's a lot more of a problem, right?
Right.
I mean, in terms of our lifestyle, right? It's like, in a way, the enemy, and, you know, I don't want to sound like a Marxist here, but the enemy is a certain type of way of living on the earth that involves a certain type of what Joanna Macy would call industrial growth society, and our version of that is capitalism, right? Corporate consumer capitalism. And the problem, of course, is that's what's eating up the earth. It molds us into consumers, and there's an awful lot of rich, powerful people who don't want to change that because they're benefiting from it. And it's going to be really hard to do that because they also largely control the political system. So I don't want to be too optimistic here in the sense of things are just naturally going to evolve to, you know, change to renewable sources of energy. I mean, I think that'll make a big difference. But when it comes to looking at the eco crisis as a whole, I think inevitably we have to confront that it really seems to require a very different way of living on the earth than we have been.
Just a quick response.
Thank you for joining us. Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Dan, obviously this is a global problem, so this may not totally apply, but I think it was Churchill who said, Americans always do the right thing after they've exhausted all other possibilities.
Yep. How long it'll take to exhaust all those other possibilities is the question. Yeah.
So we have some raised hands here. Yeah. So let's go with Lynn and then Bethany and then Ivan. Okay. Lynn, go ahead.
Suzanne is also up too. Sorry, go ahead, Lynn.
So I'm wondering what people think about governmental policies as to helping the eco-dharma crisis. For example, when China had the one-child policy, I'd like to hear what people think. If that's a helpful thing, is it a harmful thing? What are your thoughts?
I've talked too much, so I'm gonna stand back here.
I also talk too much, but I think that overpopulation and the way that we have procreated is dangerous for the earth. I have to agree with that. When I was born, there were 2.5 billion people on the face of the earth. Now, 69 years later, there are more than three times, there are 8 billion people on the face of the earth. So we are very good at procreating, and we are very good at survival. So thinking about the earth as a place of limited resources, yeah, perhaps this is not a bad idea. Just an anecdote. When I came back from Barrie, Massachusetts, Barrie, my youngest son, who is recently married, say, Dad, knowing what you know today, would you have children? And I think I told to some of you this story, and it broke my heart to say, no, I wouldn't, knowing what I know today. And I know that you have two beautiful grandchildren, Lynn, and you sent us the picture. So thank you.
Can I just turn it over for 1 minute to Tavit?
Hi, David. I was taking some notes while you were speaking. You can't read these. But if you don't mind, if I sort of read from this,
sure.
Just because it's sort of confusing and it's maybe it'll be clearer as I get it out. I would preface this with saying that I'm somewhat of a determinist, and might not this period of time where we're becoming aware of the ecological destruction, might not it be necessary for our physical and our spiritual development? Because until we're pushed to the limits of, do we ever really see the necessity of change? So should we not in some way be appreciative for this time? We're always talking about how disastrous it is and how depressive it is, but I see this as a period of time which requires us changing, both physically and emotionally and spiritually. It seems to me that most disasters in the past have always led to new understandings of the way that we confront reality. So isn't there some, you know, standing outside taking a more abstract Vedic kind of view, can we not have some appreciation at the same time that we see a necessity to do something?
Wow, what a great comment there. There's a couple different dimensions to that for me, you know, and what I immediately reflect on, it seems to me the kind of economic and social system we have today, the kind of extreme consumerism and economic focus on economic growth, that this is fundamentally, I mean, I often think of consumerism as the real religion of the modern world. You know, if we understand religion as what teaches us what's really important and how to live on the earth, well, I think consumerism is where it's at for most people, even if they go to church on Sunday and or the mosque on Saturday. And so what's going to shake us out of that? I mean, given the incredible forces, the you know, advertising and political pressure and all that, what's really going to shake us out of a system, out of a false religion that doesn't really make people happy? And it does seem like it's something like this that's going to be necessary to sort of shock the world out of its present direction or focus. But you know, the other side I want to say is I always feel a little uncomfortable thinking this way, because I'm also aware, as a white male middle class American living a rather comfortable life, it's sort of, in one way, it's easy for me to sort of say that intellectually. I think it would be a lot harder to think about that or sort of accept that if I were a Bangladeshi in a flooded field, or, you know, there's an awful lot of people suffering now ecologically. I mean, as some people say, the ecological crisis is already happening, just not so much in the US. I mean, it's already huge disasters in lots of what we used to call the third world. So that's what makes me little, it's like there's a lot of sacrifice victims involved in this understanding, and maybe that'll get us too in the end, but it's not necessarily a thought that is completely comforting, let me put it that way. Yeah. Does that make any sense?
So
yeah, thank you.
Just want to manage time a little bit here. We have Bethany and Ivan and Suzanne and Nellie and Oren and Donna, okay? So
how much time do we have, Piero? Because I somehow I had it in my head 10:30 for me.
It's we're going to, well, for you, what time is it there right now?
9:42, so that would give me another 45 minutes, but I forget how long you're scheduled this for.
It's exactly what your time, the time you have available. Your schedule is our schedule today.
Okay,
it's,
good.
It really is a gift to us. So we are using the gift as much as we can. But let's keep it short. And Bethany, you're next. And then Ivan, and then Suzanne. Oh, and Nelly, do you want to go first? Okay, Nelly, go ahead. And sorry, Bethany. Go ahead, Nelly.
I'm so sorry to skip the line.
Okay, go ahead.
It's such a pleasure, David, to be in your presence and to hear from you reading the words. I haven't read the entire book, but it's there's a lot there that resonates. And something that you just touched on, and I'm really grateful that you mentioned, which is around how we, how different people systemically experience matters of the environment or even mindfulness practice, right? Especially when it comes to the history of race and colonialism, that seems to be, as a humanity is, I feel, is becoming more and more aware of the legacy of colonialism in the West. And so Piero and I are working together on this program called Be Nature. And one of the things in my own sort of journey in doing this work and getting involved in, somebody mentioned policy, getting involved kind of in the multilateral system around dealing with climate change and trying to bring in a sense of consciousness and mindfulness and eco-dharma in that process, both helping activists to heal, but also recognizing that environmental justice is a huge, huge issue. That we can't, it feels sometimes like it's almost impossible to deal with this issue of eco-dharma, both the practice of mindfulness as a form of social activism and healing the planet, quote unquote healing the planet, without coming to terms with the past. I was at in Glasgow last year, and it was pretty obvious that there are two camps of people, people who understood that and people who didn't. Mm-hmm. And that was willing, and people who were willing to have that conversation, and people were just like, let's just go for the technological solutions. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a problem of consciousness, really, because once we really become aware that our experience isn't the only way that this problem is being experienced in the world, I feel like mindfulness is like one of the main ways that we can invite folks who may not be part of their day-to-day experience, as you mentioned, but because you are a human being that is at least attempting to be aware, this is something we can work towards. So I sometimes feel a little bit like Piero said, what I'm doing, you know, I hope is making a difference. But there is some resistance in the world to even recognizing that that is a huge part of the problem. So anyway, I just wanted to hear your thoughts or anybody's thoughts on that.
Wow. Thank you for saying that. And if I can just jump in here, I agree completely with what you said. And I also think this is, well, you know, maybe one book can't do anything, everything. But I think this is a lack in the Eco-Dharma book, that it doesn't talk really, I mean, there's some reference, I think, in chapter two, but it doesn't really get into issues of, you know, climate justice, ecological justice. And, you know, we really need to bring that in all kinds of ways. I mean, we could get into a discussion of that, but you're exactly right there, that ultimately we cannot separate ecological, or we should not try to separate ecological issues from issues of race and ethnicity. And the other thing that I would add is also class. Again, that's another lack in the book. The gap between rich and poor now, according to some people, is greater than it has ever been in human history. One statistic I saw is that the top 1% of people in the world own 50% of the world's resources, and the bottom 50% may have as little as 1%. It's like this incredible gap, and when you apply it, when you look about who's responsible for carbon emissions, fossil fuel emissions, guess what? The 1% with their private jets and their yachts and their multiple homes, you know, it just reminds us this is also a class problem. So all of these, everything is interconnected there, and we really need to, I think, look at these issues in ways that haven't been sufficiently looked at yet.
I just want to throw a thought in that's connected to that, and that is, acknowledging Indigenous and ancient wisdom traditions that have all pre-colonialism. It was a cultures of being connected to the earth. So,
thank you.
Yep.
Thank you, Nelly.
And I think Buddhism has to learn from those traditions. You're right. Well, I'll stop there. Again, I'm talking too much.
Yeah. No, you're not. And so we already have a few chapters for your next book right there. Bethany, and then Ivan, and then Suzanne.
Well, it goes back, now I have to go back far to, because I keep wanting to respond to what people say, but one thing is that I forget someone who talked about the whole idea of basically crisis is opportunity, and that it is, and I think Joanna Macy talks about this too, it is an amazingly powerful time for people to do new and different things. And I think that's exciting, actually. I think that looking to government for answers is not a real viable option, because I think government follows public opinion. So they're always kind of behind. So the more public opinion, you know, turns in this kind of direction of awareness, the more responsive government can be. And I do think it happens, and it is happening, and that there is more awareness, and there is a great turning happening, even in corporate levels, that making decisions in corporate boardrooms has begun to include environmental awareness. Probably because it can be a moneymaker, but still it will change, and investment will change, and that will make a big difference. And one last thing is, if again, back to the New York Times, the conservative opinion writer in the New York Times, Brett Stevens, wrote a very, very long article and basically recanted his kind of climate denier status of several years ago after he visited Greenland. And then he wrote a very, very long and persuasive and detailed piece about how important this is, that this is a real deal. And I think there are a lot of conservatives who read him. I mean, a lot of people read him, but he's a powerful conservative voice. So I thought that was a pretty encouraging message from a guy who has a lot of, has a very big audience. That's all.
Thank you. I also read that article. I thought it was very, yeah, my response was similar to yours. I was really happy to see how he's come along. Yeah.
Wonderful. Ivan, and then Suzanne.
Yes, hello, everybody. It's so good to be in this discussion. So it's both a comment and a question for David and for everybody. So in the past few years, I've been reading a lot about, well, Buddhism as usual, but on ecological issues. And one thing that struck me is that whenever you read something, the person's point of view seems to be, this is what we have to tackle now. Like a lot of Americans writing about the environment, well, it's technical. If we do the Green New Deal, we're going to get out of it. If you look at spiritual traditions, well, you know, it's a spiritual crisis, really. If you look at the politicians, they say, well, we need to change the system. And I was really confused about all that and didn't know how to do. And recently, I was reading more things from Canada, of course, US and the UK as well. And recently I fell upon a whole stream of people really concerned by the environment in France and Belgium, since I speak French. And there's people who are very, very concerned there. And there's all this theory that you might have heard of, David, about the collapse. Like, there's even a word for it, the collapsology or something, because everything is collapsing. And so recently, just in the past few days, actually, I was on YouTube videos, and one used to be very conservative neoliberalism economist, who now has a very high post in the Belgium, in a Belgium institution, is saying, I was wrong. We cannot continue with growth. It's not possible. And so the journalist asked him, so how do you, he says, well, we have to look at greed. And I was really struck by that. He says, we have to slow down. We have to be with our families. And this guy is very concerned. I mean, he used to be, Reagan and Thatcher were his heroes, right? He's now in his early 60s. So I was really struck by that. And another one that I was listening at yesterday, actually, who's an engineer, he said, well, we have to realize that growth is just like COVID. It's exponential. So he calculated that in a few hundred years, we would have to cover the entire Earth with solar panels if we continue growing at about 3% a year. So, and he was also saying, we need to look at how we live. And he's an engineer. The other one was so my question, in a sense, David, is that in your trips in Europe, have you felt that, in a sense, spiritual traditions, not only Buddhism, what can we bring to the table, not to us, because we all think the same way in this call, but to people, to say, well, actually, we might have a little method here if we want to look at greed, you know, which might be prayer, which might be mindfulness, might be looking at the three poisons. So I don't know, David, do you have anything to comment? Have you seen anything? Have you discovered a hidden gem somewhere in Europe?
Good question, and thank you. Thank you for all of that. Your recounting at the beginning reminded me that, as somebody said, it's only an economist to think that you can have indefinite growth on a finite planet, right? I mean, it's like, well, where have you been for the last 50? I mean, it's like, what kind of head trip are you, you know? In other words, I'm happy they finally got the point, and just curious why it took them so long. But anyway, that when it comes back to greed, I mean, I think this is one of the major intersection points, right, between Buddhism and the ecological crisis, right? Greed, right? The first of the three poisons. And it connects with the Four Noble Truths, and desire or craving being the cause of dukkha. So that's huge. And I think that's what we have. And then add to that greed, craving, as Buddhism emphasizes, it doesn't really make you happy, right? As I like to say, why is more and more always better if it can never be enough, right? You've heard me say that, I'm sure. So I think it's good for all of us to kind of keep that in mind as one of the major sort of things to the points to sort of keep coming back to. Now, when you ask about Europe, it's really harder to say where they're at, frankly. It's like, I was always speaking to small groups, right? So somehow that I can get a feeling for the larger culture from that, it's hard to say. Those are kind of self-selected people. I do talk a lot about greed in my presentations, and you know, everyone nods, they seem to get the point, but it did feel to me that to a large extent I was talking to the converted. And just remember, I think, except for that Ecodharma Center in Northeast Spain, they're just getting started. They're just starting to feel their way into this. And so the kind of thing that you're talking about, I think, is really, really important. Frankly, I think that Europe is a little behind us there, but that they're moving sort of in the same direction. So I'm not really in a position where I can say any more about how they're addressing, you know, the economic situation. I mean, one place I did say was an eco-village in north central Germany, Sevenlinden, or Sebenlinden, as they called it. And there, you know, they were kind of interesting what they were doing, you know, living off the grid, and, you know, a large community, 150 people, partly they were surviving by providing places for like conferences, but you know, ones that are relevant to the sort of thing we're talking about. I guess that's a long answer to your comment regarding Europe. To summarize, I don't know.
David, I want to interject and ask you to talk about growth again, because it was so revealing to me when you talk about corporations and governments, and even on the personal level, we are focused on growth. Can you expand a little bit about this?
Well, I mean, one of the ways I approach it in the book and elsewhere is how it is that the three poisons have been institutionalized, right? I mean, historically, in Buddhism, the three poisons are sort of the Buddhist version of sin, right? I mean, it's like that's where the problems come from, as it were. I mean, we don't believe sinning, disobeying, being God, but where does dukkha, where does suffering come from? Well, comes back to greed, ill will, delusion, the way they, and I think what we really need to see is how they've been institutionalized. And one of the ways, maybe the most obvious, is economically. I think, frankly, our economic system, corporate consumer capitalism, for all its virtues and creativity, and like most of you, I'm a huge beneficiary of it, you know, in many ways. Nonetheless, it basically depends upon growth, and calling it institutionalized greed. The basic point there is that the greed has taken on a life of its own. It's not simply that there's greedy people in the corporation, but rather those who do not promote the ideology of growth, higher profits, higher market share, higher stock prices. If they don't do that successfully, they're going to be replaced. That's just the way the system functions. And so I think we need to see the institutionalization of greed, ill will, delusion. And that also, for me, points to the response that we also have to work. We can't simply try to respond to that individually by, you know, reducing our own carbon footprint. We also have to come together as stronger sanghas, stronger communities, to address those kinds of basic problems. Is that what you had in mind, Piero?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much. Let me pass the baton on to Suzanne and then Donna.
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you, Piero and David. It's a real honor to share space with you today. I just kind of wanted to bring a little bit, and I'm going to lean into the traditional sense of hope, simply to say that the work that I'm now doing, and Piero knows because he's come and spent some time with me, is actually at a 20-acre forest and nature preserve just 20 miles south of Miami, Patch of Heaven Sanctuary. And I am engaging in mindful-based nature immersion experiences throughout the grounds. We have old growth Florida forest, so we actually take forest walks. We are also building the world's first mindful pocket park, which is based on the five sensory stations of five things you can see, four things you can hear, three things you can smell, two things you can touch, one thing you can taste. And then in that experience, you will be invited to do a 10-minute guided practice of be the tree, be the rock, or be the butterfly. And we raise, rear, and release butterflies. And we teach that as part of nature as the best teacher. And one of the things that I'm so honored that the gentleman who is the funder, because he's the funder and the founder behind us, we're a nonprofit social impact project, is that he really believes that climate change is a crisis of disconnection, and that disconnect from the inside out, with self first, with other second, and then with nature. And so I've been honored since being with them in February to bring in some conversation around Aini, or right relationship with sentient beings, and whether they're furry or feather or slimy or scaled or walking or with two or four legs. And what we're really trying to do, and we've begun to speak about it a little bit more embracingly internationally with the Global Mindful Society Institute out of Canada. They invited us to speak about why mindfulness plus nature is a key to human resilience. We're seeking in Miami to also move into the conversation about Miami being such a primary ground zero for climate resilience that is deeply focused on built infrastructure, but very little at the ASP Climate Ideas Conference press conference that was last week. no one in the room spoke about human infrastructure, the human capacity to bounce back, or even the human teachable trends to not flip your lid. We're leaning into that. One of my teachers, Jack Kornfeld, and I just want to close by saying that one of the things that he laid upon my heart, and I'm hoping with Piero and others to begin to walk this into kissing the earth with it, is that we really, what we need right now, as the technical giants that we are and the ethical that we seem to be, is for us not even necessarily to sign accords. It's at the matter of we need a change of heart. That at the core of all of it, what we really need is not here. It's the 18-inch journey down here. So I just am honored, and I hope this is the many conversations we get to all have together. Thank you, Piero, for putting this together.
Thank you, Suzanne. Yeah, we all believe that we need to change our hearts, and this isn't the important work that we are all doing. We are all pioneers as well of this big change that needs to happen, or we are the carriers of embers that you know, will keep the fire alive in the future. So thank you, Suzanne, for the good work that you do. And Donna?
Hi.
Hello.
So one thing I wanted, just listening to everything, one thing that came to my mind was that, you know, of course there's people who deny this and whatnot, but then there's a lot of people like us who really seek climate change. And I think one of the problems is that, just like a friend of mine who's a consultant who says she works, and then doesn't see the fruit of her efforts. Like, we never know what we're doing, the little bit we're doing, whether it's making a difference. So should I go back into the garage and get those plastic bags and bring them, you know, to the recycling Publix? Does it make a difference? It's hard, I think, for people to realize that if everyone did stuff, what an impact it would have. And I guess that's going back to what Lynn was talking about with government. In a way, government would help, because like when I go visit my parents in New Jersey and I go to the food store with them, they only have they don't have any more plastic bags, none. So you either buy a bag or you carry it out to your car one by one, but you're not getting a plastic bag. And so I think for a lot of people, those types of things need to be instituted, because people aren't going to change. People want to do what's convenient, and they don't think, you know, not using that straw is going to make a difference to, you know, to the environment and to the sea turtles. So, I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but that's just what I was thinking as I was listening. I wish people could understand that what they did had more of an impact.
If I can just say something very briefly about that, that kind of connects earlier with, you know, what somebody was saying is how governments respond to, what am I trying to say here? In terms of causality, it's like, you know, do we depend on governments to change? Do we depend on people to change governments? And I think there's kind of both ways. It's not simply a matter of saying, you know, only focusing on a change of consciousness. It's like what governments do is going to make a difference. So it's like it's reciprocal, I guess.
Yeah.
And when I think about responding to, say, the ecological crisis, I feel a personal responsibility to try to lower my own carbon footprint in whatever ways I can. But I also feel pretty clearly that that's not going to be enough, that I've also got to do various types of political and pressure and voting and maybe civil disobedience. So it's like, I think all of those are called for. We're different people. Maybe we're going to focus on one or the other. But I think we need to do that. Yeah.
Thank you.
That's just what came to mind in response to what you said. I also wanted to say something about the previous comment, but it's flown right out of my head, so maybe it'll come back. Yeah. And again, you know, other people, please feel free to sort of plug in here. Don't just make this a private conversation between me and somebody.
Anybody else? There are a few comments on the chat. I wasn't able to read them because I was paying attention to things that were unfolding. But perhaps I could. So Lizzie. So Juliet, why don't you unmute yourself? You wrote about David being the keynote speaker at the March 2022 conference. Why don't you?
That was fun.
Yeah, it's so good to see you, David. I wanted to just put an open invitation to us here in this group, if there are people that might be interested in putting together a proposal for the 2023 conference, because the group is focused on contemplation and higher education, but is friendly to K-12 and invites contemplatives that are allies of thinking about education and society. How can these things change? And, you know, it's over 100 people to be impacted by something. And we got, you know, wonderful comments in our survey, David, from your keynote talk. You know, it was a highlight of the conference for a number of people. And I'm sure deeply informative and moving and disturbing, unsettling in very positive ways, the ways we need to be disturbed and unsettled by this. So I'd like to make sure I'm a member of the planning committee for the 2023 conference. And there are these round table discussion sessions. And there are also contemplative practice sessions in themselves. And I can see Ecodharma or other contemplative approaches, such as Joanna Macy's work, being introduced at the conference, either in a practice session or a roundtable or both. And those are sessions that the roundtable requires three people to collaborate on a proposal. So I just wanted to make an open invitation to anyone here that might have interest in coming to a conference in March 2023 in Roanoke, Virginia. I'll definitely proceed for sure in this direction. This is what I want my own work this year at the conference to discuss. I'm currently also doing the Ecosattva training through the One Earth Sangha with another nonprofit for which I teach and design contemplative courses. That's called Instill Mindfulness. And Instill Mindfulness has a group of about 15 of us from the community that are doing the Ecosattva training, and then we're debriefing it together regularly. So just, yeah, new possibilities. How can we organize? How can we make an impact? And we want the ripple effect. We want to as many droplets in the water, creating ripples as we can. So that's my invitation. And Daniel.
Thank you for the good work you do, Juliet. And everybody can contribute with a few droplets on that cup. You know, the appendices of the book are really kind of very inspiring. The appendix 3 is Getting Real About Climate Change, Simple and Practical Steps. And the appendix 4 is the Ecosattva Vows from Active Hope by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone. So do we have any questions? Otherwise, I will read the... Dan, go ahead. You have to unmute yourself, Dan.
Actually, before we go on to that, I wanted to ask Juliet if she could elaborate a little bit more about the content of this Ecosattva training.
David likely knows far more than me. I'm just starting. There's a number of weeks of curricula, and the One Earth Sangha is, I think, based in Washington, D.C., and members, of course, globally. And they have a week by week curriculum that they're releasing. Started, I think this is the third week maybe, and it goes through third week of November. And they encourage groups to register and to then have their own debrief sessions to make meaning from the curriculum. It can also be done as an individual self-guided practice. And I will admit, in full honest disclosure, I have prioritized this group. And so I have not completed all of the immersion in the materials yet. I'm hoping to start in the coming week. But I wanted this Ecodharma book club to be my priority until it was concluded. And then I hope to begin just after with the Ecosapa materials. So for Piero and the members of this community, if there are more that would like to do a round of discussion on Ecosapa training, and perhaps to they were able to make a group organizational discounted rate for Instill Mindfulness. And so it was $45 for the discounted group rate for access to all the materials, guided practices, and talks. And you continue to have access after the period of time in which they post week by week. So you get lifetime access to these materials. I felt like it was a very reasonable investment. And I would also be interested in helping organize a different group, because I'm behind my own community in Instill Mindfulness. They're just ahead of me because I wanted to finish this community myself.
Thank you, Juliet. Thank you.
Yeah, maybe I can add briefly to that, you know, they've been doing this training for some time now, several years, and I've sometimes been one of the presenters. And I do want to recommend it highly because they have a great variety of presenters. And they encourage people, as Juliet said, not just to do it individually, but to do it with groups. And I think that can be very powerful. And you know, there's some other things like that going on. I don't know, are people familiar with the Eco Chaplaincy program out in the Bay Area? Gil Fronsdale has this new Eco Chaplaincy. And also, I think in Santa Fe, why can't I remember the name? No, there are programs like this going on. And I think, you know, they can be very powerful. So it's worth sort of looking into them. Yeah.
Wonderful.
Piero, before I just remembered what I wanted to say earlier.
Yes.
Is it okay? I think I'm still not over jet lag, although frankly, I'm pretty sure I can't blame it all on jet lag. Anyway, I've got to take better notes, I know. Okay. I was struck about the program of this center south of Miami. Who was it who was speaking about that?
Suzanne,
yeah, thank you. That's fascinating to me. And it also seemed to me very Buddhist in the sense that, you know, you could argue that for Buddhism, the fundamental problem is disconnection. I think we're all familiar with this anatta teaching of no self. And what we don't always realize is that it's what it's really doing, it's denying sense of separation, right? The delusion of a self is also the delusion of an other that's separate from the self. And so the Buddhist critique of anatta is really a denial of duality, denial of separation. And I just love the way those exercises can help us overcome that sense of separation. You know, our own Buddhist practices can too, but those kinds of sensory things just seem wonderful to me. So thank you for that. I'm really, the other thing, just very briefly, I agree completely, we need a change of heart. I would also add to that, we need a new story, right? It's like they go together. That in a way, who was it who said we're between stories? It's like the old story of progress, economic growth, technological development, the future is gonna be better and better, you know, da-da-da-da. That story has fallen apart, especially for really young people. They know that that ain't their future. And part of our struggle, part of our concern is finding the new stories that express this new heart. So I guess I just wanna emphasize the two sides of it. So anyway, thank you again, Suzanne.
Yeah. Well, a few announcements of the things that are unfolding. Next Wednesday, one of the participants in the Rocky Mountain retreat, Sylvie is a filmmaker, and she has done a beautiful documentary called Love, Thy Nature. So you did receive an email from me, and I'll resend that email for you to watch the movie, because she's going to be with us, as David is here with us today. She will be with us next Wednesday at 11. And so we're going to have an opportunity to hear from her. And she does a lot of stuff as well, not only the film itself, but she goes around and she leads groups into nature immersion as well. So that's a good thing. For the local guys here, there is a weekend retreat that I'm co-facilitating. It's an insight meditation silent retreat. This weekend, from Friday to Sunday, I'm co-facilitating. And probably if you don't have the information and if you would like to come, get in touch with me, you have my email. And then the next weekend, we're going to have a little taste of immersion in nature. It's a program with Nelly that I'm co-facilitating with Nelly called Be Nature. And it's pretty much piggybacking on our experiences, and including my experience in Colorado this year, just trying to do what I don't do, to talk less and feel more. Wonderful. Okay. Does anybody would like to say anything else? Otherwise, I would propose that we read the Ekosatva vows. Is that okay with everybody? Yes, Suzanne, unmute yourself.
I wanted to, Piero, you and I are already in conversation. Correct. But I would love to offer if there is any way that Patch of Heaven Sanctuary could be a connection and an inflection point for some of this practice. We're here, and I just open that door. And I would like to say, however that might call upon people, maybe David, you feel called. Be Piero, you and called, but it's the direction that we're moving in. So
I'll send the website of Patch of Heaven Sanctuary, so people can read more and see the beautiful. It's a wonderful place. It's simply wonderful. So I have tried to bring the Sangha over there, and I'm going to redo my efforts to bring the entire Sangha over there. Mm-hmm. So we spend the day over there and we learn from you, Suzanne. So that would be wonderful. Anyone else? Okay. I'm going to read this and then perhaps we can unmute ourselves, say goodbye and the final words. But there's a great sense of gratitude to all of you for doing the work that you do, for being here, for practicing. And, you know, we're doing this for ourselves, but naturally we're doing this for the world and for all sentient beings. We treat them very poorly. We need to treat them better. So you don't need to look at the screen. You can close your eyes if you so want. I'm going to be Joanna Mace's voice here. I vow to myself and to each of you to commit myself daily to the healing of our world and the welfare of all beings. I vow to myself and to each of you to live on earth more lightly and less violently in the food, products, and energy I consume. I vow to myself and to each of you to draw strength and guidance from the living earth, the ancestors, the future generations, and my brothers and sisters of all species. I vow to myself and each of you to support others in our work for the world and to ask for help when I need. I vow to myself and to each of you to pursue a daily practice that clarifies my mind, strengthens my heart, and supports me in observing these vows. Joanna Macy. Okay, everybody, I'm going to give voice to all of you, but before I do that, I'm going to do what I usually do. So if you want to join me in bringing the hands together, so we bring our hands together to express gratitude to each other for being here, for showing up, for practicing, and we bring to mind once again that our practice is not selfish. We do not practice for ourselves alone. Our practice benefits the entire world. So we thank each other, saying with a bow, thank you for your practice. Thank you. So you know the drill. I'm going to call your name, and if you want to say one word or a few words, let's do that. I'm going to start with Nancy, and then Donna and Oren. Nancy?
My word, I guess, today is definitely gratitude, the feeling that I have toward all of you, David, particularly as our guest, but sharing your knowledge and your time and your love. And thank you all.
Thank you, Nancy. Oren, Donna, and then Oren.
So I also thought gratitude for all the reasons Nancy just said.
Oren, and then Marcella.
I'll go with transformation and engage.
Transformation and engagement. Marcella, and then Suzanne. Unmute yourself, Marcella, please.
Just overflowing with lots of gratitude to everyone, especially you, David, for your amazing contribution. And I love the Ekosattva vows. Anything that talks about honoring our ancestors, it's just so beautiful and how synchronistic that today in my culture, Mexico, this is the Day of the Dead, and we honor our ancestors, and here we are. Because vowing to them to help us and guide us through the sacred collapse of the old paradigm. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Marcella. Suzanne, and then Bethany.
Mother Nature plus human nature equals new human story.
One more time, Suzanne.
Mother Nature plus human nature equals the new story.
Beautiful. Love that. Bethany, and then Wayne.
I'd like to express gratitude to you, especially David, because the retreat with you and Barry really did kind of change the trajectory of my mind. And I'm really grateful to you for that. It's really a new world for me.
Beautiful. Thank you. Lynn, and then Reagan.
So connection, this Eco Dharma book club. Thank you, Piero, David, and each and every one of you. And as Suzanne put it so beautifully, may we be the tree, the rock, and the butterfly.
Want to be the tree, the rock, and the butterfly as well. Reagan, you need to unmute yourself, and then Juliet.
Yeah, much gratitude to you, Piero and David. So good to see you and everyone today. Thank you for your shares. And my words are full heart.
Beautiful. Juliet, and then Stevie.
I would like to add a vow that I will dedicate the rest of my life to helping build a new story.
Wow, beautiful. Thank you. You touch me. Beautiful. Stevie, and then the birthday boy.
I just want to thank all of you for your practice. This is pretty much how it's done. And I'm very grateful for all of that. Thank you, all of you.
Thank you, Stevie. Dan, and then Ivan.
I just want to say dangerous times are good times for practice.
The dangerous times, Ekosattvas. Very good, Dan. And happy birthday again, man. Ivan, and then Devendra.
Compassion sprinkled with a bit of equanimity.
Yes. Beautiful. Devendra, and then Penelope.
Well,
First of all, gratitude to Piero and David, and I really enjoyed the book.
Thank you.
And also, be the best version of yourself you can be.
Be the best version of yourself you can be. Oren said, adding to all to vote. Yes. If you haven't voted yet, please vote. And Penelope. Penelope said, gratitude. Thank you for healing the world, David. Yeah. I already expressed, so I'm going to give the final words to David, but I already expressed my love and joy and full heart for all of you. So let's get together and let's keep doing the work every day. David, you close today.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Thank you all. I have to say, I really feel so happy having spent this time with all of you. You know what? May each of us do what we can, you know, to contribute to the healing of our earth, which will also heal us. That's the amazing thing. Yeah. Thank you all. Good luck on your path. May our paths intersect again sometime. I surely hope so. And thanks in particular to Piero, who I know worked hard to make this morning possible. Thank you, Piero.
Thank you all. Why don't you unmute and say goodbye?
Hi, everyone.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody. Hi, everyone. Well, hasta luego.
Hasta luego.
Ciao.
Happy birthday. Thanks to everybody. Be safe. Beautiful day. Thank you. Yes.
Bye-bye. Wonderful.
I seem to be able to leave.
Juliet, we're going to be talking offline again, okay? And Stevie, we're going to be talking again offline. But for now, David, thank you, man. You're a good guy.
You're not so bad yourself, Piero. Yeah. Thank you.
I'm going to talk to St. Peter and tell him to allow you in.
All right. Well, I'll appreciate your help because I might need it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Devendra. Bye, Juliet. It was good, huh?
Oh my gosh.
Oh my gosh. He was so relaxed. He's such a good guy. Oh, I need to stop recording.